Welcome to another episode of IC Doc Talk. Today I'm going to just talk about crazy stuff that happens in the cardiac ICU. Just some things that have happened and lots of stories, and I will try to convey the complexity and the craziness of a big part of my job, which is working in the cardiac ICU and working with ECMO. So I'm going to share some things here. I'm going to share some stories. That's mostly what this will be, is medical stories. My intent is to educate you about cardiac surgery and this patient population and ECMO as well, which is a big part of my practice. Many details will have been changed about a lot of these patients, so that probably people that were there probably won't even recognize that I'm talking about the same patient. So I am changing altering a lot of details in ways that I will not tell you, because I want to make sure everything is anonymous. The events and everything, all these things actually happen. So I got a lot to say today. So here we go. I don't even know where to begin with the crazy week I had a few months ago. So many things happened. It is basically impossible to convey the complexity of intensive care. Not just cardiac ICU, but all intensive care. If you're not involved in it, if you don't know what it's like, it is impossible to understand what it's like. I know that sounds a little snobbish, but it's very difficult for you to understand what it is like working with such incredibly sick patients. So that's my intent today, is just to talk about it. But so yeah, okay, where do we even begin? Okay, so I was called bedside to a patient in the cardiac ICU, not the cardiosurgical ICU. So I work in the cardiosurgical ICU, but I'm often I go to the cardiac ICU, because a lot of these are patients with bad hearts, right? They have heart failure, or they have bad arrhythmias, or things like that. So it's intensive care, but it's run by a cardiologist. So, and as an ECMO practitioner, I'm often called over there to assess patients for ECMO candidacy. And a lot of times I'm called when a patient is already in cardiac arrest. And this is what I'm about to tell you. So I was called to this patient, this woman who was in cardiac arrest already. I come into the room and chest compressions were already ongoing. And they had placed a Lucas device, which is that piston machine that pumps the chest up and down. So this patient had a heart attack a day prior and went to the cath lab, which is like where a cardiologist goes in and they squirt the coronary arteries and they look to see if there's blockage in the coronary arteries. And then they go in and they either do a pop it open with a balloon, or they put a stent. Usually they put a stent. That's what people do with a heart attack. When you have a heart attack, you come in, you go to the cath lab, they take a look if there's a, what we call a culprit lesion, some sort of plaque that can be opened up to reperfuse the heart muscle. So the patient had had that the day before and did fine. Actually, that's not true. She coded. Sorry to laugh. She actually had a brief cardiac arrest in the cath lab as well, which is also a very common place that I show up, is in the cath lab when people have cardiac arrest. So that happened the day before. She had done, she briefly had cardiac arrest, but got through that and was in the cardiac ICU. And now she was arresting again after extubation. So she was extubated. And she, about, I don't know, 20 minutes later or something like that, she arrested. So that's when I was called to the bedside. Now, just keep in mind, I was not the primary team for this patient. So there was already a team taking care of this patient. And then I was called because I'm an ECMO practitioner. I was called to assist for ECMO candidacy. So I come to the patient's bedside, and if you know me and if you listen to my podcast, you know what I do in an emergency, medical emergency. I use my senses to understand what is going on first, because that's the quickest way to gather information right up top. So I can see there's a Lucas machine going, which is a piston that pumps on the patient's chest, rather than manual compressions from a human being. So, which is great, really frees things up, and it ensures really good chest compressions, assuming that it's applied well. The patient was intubated, and obviously they were, trying to resuscitate the patient. So, and I looked at the patient. So when I'm assessing I've talked about this all the time, but when I'm assessing to put a patient on ECMO, some of the first things I ask are, was this a witness arrest? Obviously, this was a witness arrest. The patient is in a cardiac ICU, so it was witness. So chest compression started promptly, and the patient has been getting high quality chest compression the whole time, meaning they have optimal brain perfusion, the most optimal it can be, because you worry about irreparable brain injury, right, after someone goes into cardiac arrest. So I wasn't worried about that. And then I briefly looked at the patient's age, patient had had a very reasonable age, meaning they weren't of advanced age. The patient didn't appear frail. And I knew the patient did not have any metastatic cancer history, and there was no contraindication to anticoagulation, which a patient needs to be put on anticoagulation once they're on ECMO, because when blood is exposed to the surfaces of the ECMO machine, it can clot easier. So I made all those determinations right quick. I had a brief conversation with the primary attending who knew the patient well, and I was like, this patient is a good candidate for ECMO, we should put them on. So I activated the ECMO, which what that does is it a whole slew of people come to the patient. Their ECMO specialist comes with all of the equipment. At my institution, we have a backpack full of all the emergency ECMO equipment. So what I do when I activate ECMO is I immediately start prepping the patient's groin in ECPR, which is ECMO CPR, right? As I've said, there's many uses to ECMO. So I start prepping the patient's groin. What I mean is I start cleaning their groin, because that is where I'm going to put the catheters or cannulas. So that's the first thing I do. I just start prepping it both sides. Or maybe I can look with an ultrasound beforehand if equipment hasn't arrived yet to see what their femoral, see if I can identify their femoral vessels well. So I'll do that, prep, equipment comes, you scrub in, I get sterile drape, I get all that ready to go. And then with ultrasound, I then get access to the femoral vein and the femoral artery. Sometimes that is difficult, particularly when chest compressions are ongoing, because the body is bouncing up and down. I have found with manual chest compressions, with somebody doing the chest compressions, it jostles the body much more, and I actually have to ask them to stop for a moment for me to get access to the femoral artery or femoral vein with my needle and a wire. But with the Lucas, the body doesn't jostle so much, so I don't have to ask them to stop. But anyway, the cannulation of this patient was fairly uncomplicated, although it took a little bit longer than I would have liked, but that's how it goes sometimes. It's hard, you know, putting someone on ECMO during chest compressions is difficult. It's technically a difficult thing, and you're under, you know, everybody's under duress, and you're all, you know, everyone's, you know, you're freaking out a little bit, and it's difficult. It's a difficult thing. And sometimes ideally you want to get someone from activation to actually getting them on the ECMO machine. Ideally it would be 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And this took a little bit longer than that, but still, it was not terrible. And then a bunch of other people come, you know, surgical staff comes to help and all that stuff. So we got the patient on ECMO, VA ECMO, venous arterial ECMO. And as soon as you get someone on ECMO, you stop chest compressions, because now those chest compressions are pointless, and now it's pointless harm to the patient. So as soon as you get flow, I put in the cannulas, and I hook up the ECMO tubing, and then you start the pump. As soon as you get flow and you know that you're flowing well, another part of this is you have to have at my institution, fortunately, we have a cardiologist come, either a fellow or somebody, to put a transesophageal echocardiogram down the patient's throat so you can look at their heart, so that I can look at my wires that I put with the femoral artery and vein, so I can make sure they're in the right place. Because again, you can make the mistake when you're cannulating someone that you think you're in the artery, but you're in the vein, or vice versa. So the way to ensure that is we thread these long wires up, and someone who's on the echocardiogram, the echo probe, they say, hey, I see your wire at the bicaval junction, meaning it is 100% on the venous side, or I see your wire in the descending aorta. Okay, great, I'm on the arterial side. And that is 100%. You know you can do it. You can't transduce the vessel, right? So if you're familiar, when you put in a central line, like in the internal jugular, to make sure you're in the internal jugular, not the carotid artery, which is bad, right? You don't want to put a line in the carotid artery. To ensure that, one, you know, you do two things. You look at your wire under ultrasound, make sure your wire is in the right vessel, and then you transduce it. One way to transduce it, you just take some tubing, you hook it up, and you hold it, draw some blood back, and you hold it vertical, and you watch the column of blood as it sinks down, and it's non-pulsatile. You can't do that in ECPR, in ECMO CPR. Why? Because the flow is terrible. You got maps of 40s or 50s, and you have non-pulsatile flow. You have terrible flow. I mean, you might have pulsatility, but your flow is terrible. So you cannot hang a column or transduce your vessels. That's not a reliable way of knowing if you're in the right vessel. Anyway, I digress. So we got this patient on ECMO, brought him to the cardiothoracic ICU, the CV ICU, the surgical ICU, which is where I work. So I work in the surgical ICU. And we stabilized the patient. The patient eventually got recovery. Let me back it up. I think we figured out that the patient didn't go in. Oh, yes, sorry, I'm forgetting. It's, seriously, so many things happened this week that I was on. I'm mixing things up. We took the patient down back to the cath lab, right? Because we were like, oh, well, one of their stents, her stent has thrombosed, which is a thing that can happen. But she went down to the cath lab, which is where a cardiologist squirts contrast dye through your coronary arteries to see if you've had a heart attack. And they were clean. So nothing had happened with her heart. Her stents were totally clean. Looking a little bit more back, it sounds like she had pretty severe mucus plugging of her lungs right after extubation. So it sounds like she actually went into hypoxic arrest. Anyways, she recovered from that and came off ECMO like a week later. So it was great. It was good ECMO. So I got a ton more stories to tell you. It was a crazy week. All right. Next time I was called again, like the same day or the next day or something, to a young woman's room who was not doing well. And she was, again, in the cardiac ICU. She had isolated right heart failure. Very, very severe. Acute, severe. She came in like the day before. She was short of breath. No history of this. Otherwise, pretty healthy. And she comes in. And an echo of her heart showed that her right side of her heart, the part of the lung that pumps to the lungs, was in almost complete failure. So when I arrived, she was not intubated. She was alert and looking at me, she was alert. And she was on astronomical doses of vasoactive or inotropic support, meaning medications, drips, to keep her heart pumping and to keep her alive. She was on. And for those of you that are familiar with the dosing, I'll tell you, she was on like epinephrine drip at like 0.5 micrograms per kilogram per minute, norepinephrine at like 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. For those that are not familiar, those are insane doses of medications, probably oversaturation, probably not even doing anything at that, doing something, but probably, anyway, also on dobutamine, vasopressin, a bicarbonate drip because her lactate was like 20, which is extremely high for those that aren't familiar. That means she's in anaerobic metabolism. She's not perfusing her tissues. Basically, this is someone who is going to die and probably would have already had cardiac arrest if she were any older. Her youth was still kind of keeping her alive in a kind of non-specific way. Anyway, so very not doing well. Probably about to cardiac arrest any moment, likely. So I was called bedside to see if we should put this patient on ECMO. After reviewing her chart and having various discussions with people, we decided, yes, definitely she's a candidate for ECMO, for VA ECMO, veno arterial ECMO. But we also, and this is a lot of, people involved in the decision making. I hope I'm not making myself sound out like the singular protagonist hero here. It's not just me that's coming in and making, right? It's multi-collaborative, lots of people involved. Anyway, so with a lot of discussion with a lot of specialties and a lot of people very involved with this young woman, we all decided it would be best to seek putting in an Impella rather than being on VA ECMO to put in an Impella. An Impella is a small snake-like pump that's inserted through a vessel like a femoral artery or an axillary artery. And in this case, it would need to go through the vein. And in this case, it was put through internal jugular vein. And it's literally like a little snake. And it's snaked up into the right ventricle. Because the axis to the right ventricle is on the venous side. The axis to the left ventricle is on the arterial side, typically. Anyway, so it's a little pump to help the right side of her heart because she was in isolated right heart failure. Her left ventricle was still pumping well. Now, pumping well, got to take out the grain of salt because it was still pumping well, but on a lot of medication support. Anyway, so we took this patient down to the cardiology cath lab where a cardiologist who specializes in this placed this Impella pump and it was a flexible Impella to really turn that curve from the right IJ into the RV and then for the outlet to be placed into the pulmonary artery. Anyway, so I was down with her the whole time, even though I wasn't technically doing anesthesia because I wasn't in my anesthesia role. I was in my ICU role. I was in the OR the whole time because I knew this patient could code anytime. And if she did, we would immediately cannulate her onto VA ECMO through her femoral vessels. So I was there the whole time. She was absolutely terrified. And also she was not an English speaker. So there is that component complexity. We were talking with her through a translator, but that made everything much more difficult, more frightening for her. And it was just awful. We couldn't sedate her at all. Because giving any more amount of sedation to someone like that is very, very dangerous. Even if it's just a little midazolam, a little benzo, a little fentanyl, you can't do it. It's way too risky. Cause it could just
just by relaxing a little bit, you can drop your vasotone a little bit, and she could rest. So we could not risk anything. So basically held her hand, you know, and a lot of local anesthetic. And so that was placed. So she was then brought up to back to the cardiac ICU, and I didn't sign off on the patient, but I wasn't involved anymore because I didn't put her on ECMO and she wasn't in my ICU. So it was like, if she codes, I'll come right away and we'll put her on ECMO. And I was like, let me know how it goes. And I was planning on following up throughout the day. Anyway, I was called back an hour later. She was not doing well. The Impella was not, it wasn't cutting it. I don't know why not. It just was not doing it. She was still on the exact same amount of pressures, still doing absolutely terrible. And honestly, at this point, I was just surprised she hadn't coded and died. So, and then she was becoming really agitated, just totally losing it, not knowing what was going on and moving things around, trying to pull things out. So at this point, it was like, we need to intubate her. She also needed a dialysis line, and she wasn't going to tolerate having a temporary dialysis line placed because she was going to kidney failure, obviously, if you're in that sort. And the kidney failure was directly related to the heart failure. She was probably getting no flow to her kidneys, if any, barely any flow to her kidneys. Her kidneys were taking a hit. So anyway, at this time, we decided to intubate her, but intubating her was also dangerous because as soon as you intubate someone like this, they can also go into cardiac arrest simply by relaxing their bodies to put in, because what's keeping her blood pressure and keeping perfusing her brain still at this point is also just her sheer adrenaline. Her endogenous epinephrine adrenaline still pumping, along with all of the pharmacological and mechanical support that we're giving her. Anyway, so we worried about, and then when you give someone positive pressure ventilation after you put in a breathing tube, you also compromise their cardiac flow. So there's many reasons that she can go to cardiac arrest. So we prepared to intubate as a team, but then we also prepared to crash her onto VA ECMO right after intubation. We even brought in a Lucas device, which is like a piston pump that you put over someone's chest to mechanically do chest compressions. We place it over her. We put her arms up over it. And then one team at the head of the bed prepared to intubate. I scrubbed in with a colleague, and we actually got access to her femoral and arterial vessels. We put in lines into her femoral vein and femoral arteries beforehand so that I could use, we put in these small lines so that we could use those lines to then crash her into ECMO. We intubated her. She actually tolerated that okay. And then we just decided at that point to then just put on ECMO because we didn't know what else to do. And now at this point, it was controversial about the decision to put her on ECMO because it was like, well, we again looked at an echo and her left ventricle was still pumping very well, her left ventricle. And you generally, VA ECMO, you don't put someone on VA ECMO when they're not in left ventricular failure. But my kind of rationale was, number one, this patient's going to die, almost certainly, if we don't do anything. She may still die even if we put her on VA ECMO. But also, the left ventricle, yeah, it's pumping well, but she was on astronomical support. She's getting right heart support, and then she's on a ton of epinephrine and norepinephrine. So it was like, I don't know if you can really say, hey, her left side of her heart is also doing well when she's also getting this much support. Anyway, after a lot of respectful discussion and everybody with very good intentions and amazing collaborative work with a lot of people, we did put her on ECMO. So we put in cannulas or these large catheters into her femoral vessels, and that all went fine because we planned and prepared accordingly, and that all was uncomplicated. We put her on ECMO quite quickly. And then, so she's now on a heart pump. So then now when someone's on ECMO, now they come to more into the cardiovascular ICU, which is different than the cardiac ICU. So we transferred the patient over there. When I left that night, her lactate was still 27. She was still on astronomical amounts of pressors. And her blood pressure was terrible. It was like 60 over 20, and her MAP was like 45. Couldn't, even after methylene blue, all these last-ditch efforts, and she was already on steroids and broad-spectrum antibiotics. I mean, she was literally on maximum medical therapy that is possible in the modern world. So I went home that night being, you know, I'm not necessarily pessimistic, but, you know, I was like, when I come in tomorrow, I'm not going to be surprised if she's passed away. Or we've stopped. Someone passing away on VA ECMO was kind of a complicated matter because you can keep them alive even if their heart is in a complete standstill. You can still keep them alive on ECMO. So anyway, whatever, I digress. I came in the next morning and she was totally off pressors and her lactate had come down from 27 to 2 overnight. She was still on ECMO, of course, but she got through it. She got through it. And then she got a biopsy of her heart, which showed lymphocytic myocarditis, also she went into left ventricular failure. Her LV crapped out, meaning we had caught her in earlier in the disease process. She had global myocarditis. It was definitely the right decision to put her via ECMO. Clearly, obviously, in retrospect. And she likely had a viral myocarditis. It resolved, her heart got better, and she got off ECMO, and she's alive. It was awesome. All right, and then, like, right around this, the next day, there was a patient in the medical ICU who was in status asthmaticus, just really, really, really bad asthma attack, really, really bad. And she was being managed in the medical ICU, which is not, I don't attend in the medical ICU. That's usually Palm critical care physicians that do that in the United States. Anyway, I was called bedside to see this patient to assess for ECMO candidacy for VV ECMO, not veno arterial, but veno venous ECMO. So talking to the staff there and reviewing the patient chart and examining the patient, she was intubated. And was her unbelievably bronchospastic. When I listened to her lungs, it was like barely a squeak. Her tata volumes and compliance were unbelievably bad. And as a result of that, her carbon dioxide level of her blood, her PCO2 was over 100. Okay, that's ventilated. A lot of you who know what I'm talking about are like, whoa. So your carbon dioxide right now floating in your blood system is, you know, anywhere between 30 and 40 when you're breathing normally. Hers was over 100 with controlled breathing. That's how bad it was. She was on all the typical therapies for asthma, you know, just pulse steroids and continuous nebs and ketamine and magnesium, and it was basically max medical therapy. So the MICU team appropriately was calling us for ECMO consideration. So reviewing her chart, there was no obvious contraindications. We placed her on ECMO. Now, this is a different kind of setting of putting someone on ECMO, right? The one I told you about before, the two ones I told you about here, were emergent ECMO. This is now urgent, meaning we have time, we can, you know, we cannulated her bedside. We didn't take her out of the OR because she had been too unstable to transport with a PCO2 of over 100 ventilated. So anyway, we cannulated there, took our time appropriately. And put a veno-venous. So she's in respiratory failure, right? Not cardiac failure. That's why you put veno-venous. You take the blood out of the venous side and you put it back in the venous side. But the reason I'm putting this patient on ECMO was completely different than the other examples I gave you. The other examples I gave you, those patients needed a heart pump to keep them going. This patient needs carbon dioxide taken out of their lungs, out of their body. That's the only reason they need to be on ECMO. Another variation of this is called ECOR, but I won't get into that. We put a cannula in her femoral vein, I think a 25 French, and in her right internal jugular, I believe a 20 French. And all that went great. Now, the cannulation went beautifully. Now, when you start people on ECMO in this setting, you got to go slow because you can take some of their blood volume out. And then you're also hitting them with cold water, which can cause changes in their hemodynamics. So you got to start the pump slow and wind it up. Anyway, and then she got transferred over to the cardiovascular ICU, where she was then extubated and taken off ECMO like a week later or something like that. So it was a great use of ECMO. That was like a chip shot ECMO. That's like when I get consoles like that, like, yes, put them on. They're usually quick turnarounds. You know, you can often get for asthma, you can get these people off ECMO in 2 days and take them out. So you should put these people on ECMO. They're a good candidate. And then I put another person on ECMO like the day next day. It was a older woman who was in end-stage lung failure from interstitial lung disease, which is like a terminal. Now, interstitial lung disease is like a wastebasket term. Many disease processes that basically scar your lungs down, pulmonary fibrosis or usual interstitial pneumonia or NSIP. There's a lot of different disease processes. I'm not a pulmonologist, so I'm not going to go too much into the weeds there, but it's basically scarring of the lungs, irreversible, and it's fatal. My dad died of this, actually. But anyway, so this guy had it. He was in the MICU. He was not intubated yet, and he was listed for a lung transplant. So I got called to, hey, should we put this person on VV ECMO as a bridge to transplant? Usually people like these are excellent candidates. Now, I've seen these patients a lot, And the way I usually kind of determine, I go and see them. I obviously examine them when they are on, and they're usually not intubated yet. You try to delay intubation because it doesn't really help. And you want them to be as robust as possible and getting up as much as possible so that they stay being a good transplant candidate. Anyway, usually these patients, they're usually, when I get called, they're usually on a high flow nasal cannula, getting at 100% oxygen delivery, and then a non-root breather mask over that. So when I come and see them and they have those two things, and they're on maxed out FiO2, and then they're breathing like 35 a minute, and they're barely saying two words in between sentences to me, those are people that I say, yeah, let's put them on ECMO. Because when you put them on ECMO, then they even go up higher on the transplant list, and then they increases their chances of getting transplant. Now, that's not the only that's not the reason you're putting them on ECMO. Obviously, it needs to be medically indicated. I would never put someone on ECMO inappropriately just to bump them up a transplant list. That's not what I'm suggesting. I hope I have not been misinterpreted. Anyway, so brought this patient to my unit, and it's nice to try to not intubate these patients, to just keep them without a breathing tube and put them on ECMO, which you can do. Lots of give them a little sedation and lots of local anesthetic, but they often cannot lie flat. They can't tolerate it. Their lungs are just too far gone and they can't tolerate it. So we intubated him or her, and then did VV ECMO. A lot of times a double lumen cannula is nice for these, like a crescent or I can't think of the name of it at the top. Avalon. But we just did a right IJ femoral cannulation for this patient, and that all went fine. Anyway, we cannulated a couple more patients. This is all just 1 week, and there's a lot more going on. But there was another interesting tidbit to add, as I was called to a patient's bed, and this was a patient who had some sort of cardiac surgery like 5 days prior, that everything went well, and he was on the step down unit, not even in the ICU, but I came into the room and he was obviously not doing well. He's breathing really fast and his heart rate was really high, and they got a chest x-ray and his entire left lung field was full, and they had pulled epicardial leads. These are pacing wires that are placed on the patient's heart when they have open heart surgery, so that you can then pace a patient's heart, because after cardiac surgery, sometimes you have problems with intrinsic pacing of the heart. So it's a convenient way to capture pacing of someone's heart. These are then pulled, or they're cut, depending on the practice. I'm not advocating for one or the other. And it's routine. These leads were pulled from the patient appropriately. No, nobody did anything wrong. It is an inherent risk. Sometimes you pull those leads and then the patient bleeds around their heart. Sometimes they'll bleed around their lung as well. So when I saw what was very likely a hemothorax, I was like, I'm pretty sure this patient is probably in tamponade, cardiac tamponade, which is where blood fills the outside of the heart and it squeezes on the heart like a vise. So the heart can no longer pump. It's a form of shock. It's a form of obstructive shock. And fortunately the patient was still alert and had a decent blood pressure, but I brought up an ultrasound on the patient's heart. The key thing that I look for when I'm ruling out tamponade is, for one thing, is there pericardial effusion? I see the effusion, and then I look for diastolic collapse. And I the first place I look for diastolic collapse is the right atrium. Why? Because it's the lowest pressurized chamber of the heart. What diastolic collapse mean? No, the chambers of your heart should not be collapsing during diastole. They constrict. They constrict during systole. And that's where you have collapse. But they should be bellowing outward, because they're filling with blood during diastole. And if they're collapsing inward, that means you've had a change in the gradient across those chambers, and that means you have too much pressure outside the heart, and that's why it's caving in the chamber. That's pathognomonic for tamponade. So I looked for that. I didn't quite see that. I didn't think I saw that with my eye, but I did see some bowing of the intraventricular septum on the right side into the left. We call that intraventricular interdependency, where the right side gets so overloaded that it starts to bow into the left side and you obstruct flow from the left side of the heart. And that is the phenomenon. That's why you have pulsus paradoxus. If you're familiar, if you're like a med student or someone listening, that's why you have pulsus paradoxus. It's because of intraventricular interdependency going on because of derangement of the chambers of the heart. Anyway, I know that was a lot of jargon. If you didn't get it, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Anyway, I saw that and I'm like, pretty sure this is tamponade. We brought this patient to the ICU. And then her pressure really started to tank. We gave her a bunch of blood, 2 units, which definitely helped her. And then after that, I was worried that So there's a couple of decision making you can do. You can put in a chest tube to help relieve that. Will, you know, that will probably help relieve the pressure around the heart. But if a patient is bleeding, you can worsen the bleed. You don't know how active the bleeding is, so it can be a little risky to do that. That is certainly one way to manage that. And I wouldn't fault anybody for managing, for putting in a chest tube and waiting. But she was so, or he was so hemodynamically unstable that, I was like, I think we need to, this patient needs to go down to the operating room, open up the chest, wash out, fix the bleeder. And the cardiothoracic surgeon, who was obviously made aware of this, came in. He also agreed, and the patient was rushed down to the OR, and tamponade was relieved and the patient did fine. Very, actually quite not infrequent, that kind of thing. I highly suspect it when it's presented with me. I'm like, this is probably tamponade, probably wash out, because I've seen it so many times. All right, that's all the time I got for story time. I hope that was helpful for whoever you are to listen and to learn from. Because, the practice of medicine, everybody's learning constantly throughout their entire career and refining and getting better. And I hope that's the reason I share these stories, is to you can hear how someone on some part of the world is practicing this kind of crazy medicine. It's how we're doing it over here. And you should share this podcast, share this episode with people, because I think these experiences I share, I think, are very valuable for many people. So share it. All right, let's talk about books. All right, nonfiction book I'm going to talk about today it's called American Midnight, The Great War of Violent Peace and Democracy's Forgotten Crisis. This is by Adam Hochschild. This was published recently, October 4th, 2022, a year ago. It's about 400 pages. I've read another book by this author, King Leopold's Ghost, which I think I talked about this on podcast a few episodes ago. Same author. That's also a great book. You can go back and listen to that episode if you find it in the notes for the episode, if you're interested in hearing about this book. Anyway, so this book, if you think things in America, so obviously it's called American Midnight. This is about American history. If you think things are bad now in American politics, go back to like 1920. Okay. Because it was, everything bad going on right now was going on then, and it was way worse. Which, not to undercut or invalidate the serious cultural and political problems that we're having now, because they're very serious. But anyway, so this historical book, it's on a sliver of American history. It's from like 1917 through about 1923. Just like, seriously, this book is just about 5 years. It spans 5 years. And this book is absolutely vital to read and understand America itself. Like, I understand America better just after reading this one book. And I'm talking about American culture and politics. Just this small window in American history will teach you why American culture and politics is so insane, and how incredibly authoritarian and downright fascist America has been up until recently, and even including now. It's not an exaggeration. It's really not. So this tale involves largely Woodrow Wilson, okay, the American president. He's like the centerpiece of this book. But a cast of other many famous figures like J. Edgar Hoover, socialist Eugene Debs, anarchist Emma Goldman, anarchist Kate Richards O'Hare, also Mitchell Palmer. A lot of this book is focused on a lot of these people. So while Woodrow Wilson, he was thought of as a progressive president, in many ways he was, because he ushered in better labor laws for children and women's suffrage and income tax, and then, the huge proponent of League of Nations. And he put the progressive Judge Brandeis into the Supreme Court, who was very influential. So he did a lot of progressive things. But Wilson ushered in an age of extreme draconian measures that resulted in an enormous war propaganda machine, along with harsh limits on free speech. So he was also extremely fascist, very clearly. He oversaw the era of the Espionage and Sedition Act, which were basically, they're just created to throw war dissenters in prison. That's literally what the Sedition and Espionage Acts were created for. And they were created under Woodrow Wilson. And many people during this time were thrown in jail just for their speech. So during this time in America, if you said anything that was derogatory about the draft that was instituted or America's decision to enter World War I, you were literally imprisoned. That's not an exaggeration at all. You were just thrown in jail. Can you imagine that happening today? No, because that would not happen today. So socialist Eugene Debs was sentenced to 10 years in prison for his 1980 2018 Canton speech. Let me say that again. He went to prison for 10 years for giving a speech. That was the crime. He gave a speech. And here's the words, some of the main words that got him thrown in prison. Okay, this is quoting him. Here, just think about this. Think about what I'm about to quote you, and this is why he went to prison. The working class who freely shed their blood and furnish the corpses have never yet had a voice in either declaring war or making peace. It is the ruling class that invariably does both. They alone declare war, and they alone make peace. That's it. That's the quote. So I know things are nuts in 2023 right now, but no one is going to prison for saying something that by today's standard is quaint, right? He literally just gave a speech about America making war. So this was an era where anti-Bolshevik and Red Scare panic literally drove federal policy across the board and provided the seeds for how the federal government would behave for the next 100 years. This set the stage for J. Edgar Hoover. 100 years ago, you were jailed or lynched simply for being who you are and having slightly non-mainstream opinions. A huge realization I had reading this book is that the American federal government agencies and policies were quite literally born from anti-leftist and anti-immigration fearmongering. Conservatives today who decry federal government intervention seem to lack the understanding that the federal government is extremely conservative to begin with. The book goes into so much detailed history during this time. The author covers Wilson's rationale of entering the World War I, which is because German U-boats sank, quote, innocent American ships. And what the American propaganda press during that time didn't mention is that those American vessels had munitions for the Allies and they were inviting the attack. Now, I'm not justifying Germans' attacks, or, you know, but America was already involved. The U.S. victimized itself to engage in war profiteering and to, quote, spread democracy. Right? Sounds familiar. It's like the rationale every time America goes to war with somebody, spreading democracy and then the U.S. victimizing themselves. Honestly, not much has changed in 100 years with that, with American warmongering. It really hasn't. It's depressing. So during this time, the National Guard was routinely used to battle labor strikes where many workers died. Can you imagine the recent labor strikes with like UPS and Amazon if the National Guard was called in to break them up? That doesn't happen today. Workers during this time enjoyed few federal protections. People were terrorized by their employers into using their wages to buy government war bonds. There were scores of white riots, literal lynching and terrorism against black people everywhere, especially Chicago and St. Louis. Members of the IWW, which is the Industrial Workers of the World, or they're also called the Wobblies, were seen as enemies of the state. They were literally just a labor organization. Mitchell Palmer, who is the eternal attorney general, issued many raids against anarchists and socialists and imprisoned many people simply for expressing their free speech or for trying to organize as a labor union. Teachers were fired for speaking out against the war, and their students were encouraged to rat on them. The American Protective League, the APL, was essentially a paramilitary group across 600 cities that did tons of the dirty work fighting anarchists and, quote, German spies or sons of German spy fearmongering. And they did this for the federal government, basically. The Postmaster General flagrantly stopped any publication that had any leftist leanings or anti-war sympathies at all. Like, the leftist censorship was insane. So what is described in this book is an era of deep government surveillance, censorship, and harsh violations of the Constitution and civil and labor rights. This is America. The legacy is entrenched to this day. Yes, civil liberty rights are way better now, but it's taken 100 years for the meager results since then, and the exact same crap is going on right now. People talk about the deep state, right? And this book is describing the real deep state, which is the out in the open, harsh restrictions of civil and labor rights by the government. The exact same forces are still at play right now in 2023. It's astonishing how some things, you know, never seem to change. So there you have it. Please read this book. I highly recommend it. It's called American Midnight. I listened to the audiobook. It was phenomenal. American Midnight by Adam Hochschild. About 400 pages. All right, let's talk about a fiction read. I'm going to talk about Brandon Sanderson, who is a well-known fantasy author at this point. Probably one of the best-selling authors ever. And I'm a big fan, of course. I've read basically all of his adult books, and this is one of his secret novel projects, if you're familiar, Yumi and the Nightmare Painter, which I really enjoyed. I'm going to share my review of this book with very minor spoilies. So very minor though. So if you don't want any spoilers at all, and I'm just going to be talking about characters, then maybe don't listen to this, but it's, again, it's very minor. So basically, you know, getting to the chase of it, I loved this book, Yumi and the Nightmare Painter. It came out this year. It just establishes Sanderson as a just an incredible storyteller. The book has flaws, which I'll get to, but he really made me care about the characters and relationships. Aside from this, you know, some of the flaws, I can honestly say I've never quite read a book like Yumi and the Nightmare Painter. And since I have so much praise for this book, I'll just start with the kind of the little problems that I had. There's a lot of narrative info dumping that happens at the resolution, which is a strange place to put info dumping. Info dumping is usually up front. And Sanderson cheats a little with this book because he's so big now and people know his book so much that as the narration is a character within his world. So, and he cheats a little bit with that. What I mean is he kind of does a bunch of like plot hole filling at the end of the book with the narration. And it's just kind of a patch job of him trying to deliver on a very cool premise of the book and setting without really putting in the work to make it make sense with like a slick narrative. If I'm making any sense, he sets up this very cool world. And then there's kind of these like little plot holes. You're like, how does this work? And then the narrative voice at the end just kind of like explains it with info dumping. It's not the prettiest way to get things done, but it didn't matter. I still loved it. He got away with it, basically. So anyway, this Sanderson somehow really got me to care about teenage characters, which doesn't say I don't care about teenage characters, but I don't like young YA books. It's not my thing.
And you could argue maybe this book had a little bit of YA stuff, but I think it did. I think Brandon Sanderson pulled it off, at least for me. And then the world was so imaginative. It was really real. I've never read anything like it. Really incredible. And then the plot, and then Sanderson is so good at plotting and resolution, all that stuff. It was just really good. I really, really enjoyed it. If you've never read Brandon Sanderson, you could start with this book. definitely. You could definitely start with this book. You might be a little confused at some of the stuff, but because it's part of the Cosmere, you know, his like big universe. But I really, really enjoyed this book. I think it's, I've read three of the secret books, and I think this was the best that I've read. But anyway, it was good. I recommend you check it out. Okay, that's all the time I got for today. Email me if you want to. My email is icudrecmo@gmail.com. If you email me, so I often will read people's emails sometimes. If you email me just for whatever reason, you want to just say hello or you like something or you have a question, if you don't want me to read it on the podcast, please tell me no. Otherwise, I will assume that I can read something of it, if that's okay. Always anonymous. I never say anybody's name. But if you email me and you don't want me to mention anything about your email on the podcast, please tell me in that email. But email me about anything. And then I'm on TikTok. ICU Doctor is my handle. I'm on Instagram, ICU Doctor TikTok. And that's it. Please share this podcast. That's how podcasts get more popular. If you like this content, I do this content for free. I don't have any advertisers. I make no money off of this. I make no money off of any of my social media content. It is a public service that I enjoy doing. If you like to share it and help it grow, I think leaving a review helps, and then sharing it with somebody. Like, I like this podcast, and sharing it helps it to grow. If you want it to grow, I honestly, it's fine with me either way. okay, thanks. I'll see you next time.